What then must we do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution, democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up, by Garal Purovitz. Chapter 4, The Fading Power of Traditional Politics. Just a couple more things before we can really get going, and to wrap up this question of whether or not change along traditional lines, I mean trend change, of course, is likely on our current path. Isn't the fact that Obama healthcare legislation passed evidence, after all, that if you really work at traditional politics, it will all work out in the end? Well, maybe. This is another case where digging a bit deeper into how things really worked in the era we are coming out of helps clarify our own challenge, the era, that is, most people have in mind when they remember the future. Americans have talked about universal healthcare for a long, long time, way back, indeed, to the time of Theodore Roosevelt. If you look closely at the historical and institutional foundations that created the preconditions of the Obama healthcare legislation, however, what you find is a tale most people simply don't know much about. A tale that puts recent events in a somewhat different perspective. First, the very idea that there should be any serious kind of health insurance for Americans, beyond tiny elites, simply did not have much reality until World War II, and it was, again, the war that gave it reality. With war labor scarce, wage-price controls were enacted to keep bidding wars in check. Corporations, unable to offer more pay, tried to compete with benefits instead. The modern idea of widespread employer-provided health insurance developed as a strategy to attract wartime workers and continued in many industries after the war, especially during the boom era. Although it is possible, perhaps even likely, that a serious demand for health care would have occurred sometime in American history, the widespread general idea that health insurance should be provided to large numbers, in fact, was and is a creation of the World War II moment in history. Second, as we have noted, one of the key constituencies that build upon this new health insurance idea and helped lead the fight for the first modern public extensions of the concept, Medicare and Medicaid, was obviously organized labor. And again, the strength of organized labor in the post-war period is inseparable from the two major system-shaping events of the 20th century, the Great Depression and World War II. Third, the important constituency that helped establish Medicare and Medicaid was, and is obviously, the elderly. And in many ways, the elderly as a political constituency, rather than an age class, was largely brought into being by Social Security in the events of the Depression. Fourth, the context in which Medicare and Medicaid became possible was also, as we have seen, the special context of the post-war boom and the financial flows it produced. Fifth, it is upon the institutional structures as well as the political economic constituencies established by these processes that further extensions were added, especially support for HMOs during the Nixon era, COBRA legislation during the Reagan administration, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP in the Clinton years, and also the massive Bush-era drug program, Medicare Part D. And sixth, it is upon this long-developing political-economic scaffolding of institutions and constituencies, ultimately explainable only by reference to the Depression, the New Deal, World War II, and the post-war boom, that Obama legislation even became imaginable. You can't just say, Obamacare passed, and therefore all we need to do is get organized and get to work. We do need to do that, but as the above suggests, that is only part of the story. Looking back, and especially looking forward, as we ask what it will take to achieve large-order, trend-changing politics in other areas. So again, it may in theory have been possible to get to this point some other way, but what in fact got us here was very, very dependent on a long series of highly unusual prior changes, the most important of which were anchored in those mid-20th century global crises called the Great Depression and the massive global Second World War. Bottom line again, I'm certainly not advocating a return of either of the above. Just trying to clarify that our theories about the power of traditional politics in this particular corporate system often ignore some very important things as people grasp for hope, or perhaps wishful thought, that traditional strategies might somehow alter those big trends, and that we really don't have to deal directly with the system that is generating the trends. What about civil rights, feminism, gay rights? Don't the transformations on these fronts tell us the system is capable of changing course by reacting to traditional politics and movements? Yes. And no. There have clearly been political successes in these areas, extremely important successes, and, thankfully, we are indeed on the way to one day genuinely achieving a society of individual respect and equality. Moreover, the kind of political activism that most people associate with progressive causes, demonstrations, movement building, civil disobedience, but also electioneering, canvassing, and all of the traditional political models, has been effective for these causes. But there are a few obvious points, and one not so obvious that we'll come to at the end, to consider here. 1. What this has been all about is getting into the existing system, not changing it. The battle for equality on all these fronts has largely been about rights and about fulfilling the enduring elements of the individualist American culture. I in no way mean to denigrate the drive to full equality. My concern is simply to keep the critical questions in focus and to remind you of those big, big decaying trends that continue on the way even as more and more people find that personal discrimination is slowly, all too slowly, declining. Professor Michael Kazin underscores the obvious point in his recent book on the left in American politics. Radicals in the U.S., he might well have added progressives in general, have seldom mounted a serious challenge to those who held power in either the government or the economy, but they have done far better at helping to transform the moral culture, the common sense of society, how Americans understand what is just and what is unjust in the conduct of public affairs. And that is no small thing. 2. World War II obviously also played a role here, helping accelerate things a great deal, producing some, not all, of the conditions that permitted successful activists and activism. Many women, for instance, were drawn deeply into the industrial workforce and then sent back to suburban homemaking, an experience that they and their daughters found world-shaking. Black Americans were drawn north, out of the cotton fields, into a different economic and ultimately social and political world, and many entered the military. The post-war world was never the same, for them and for their sons and daughters. At the same time, we rarely consider fully the implications of the simple truth that it was not until the two-thirds point of the 20th century that Black Americans were able to vote in most parts of the South, in a democracy that looked the other way while white terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan enforced the old order in a vast region of the nation home to 30% of the entire population with violence and murder. 3. There has also been backsliding in several areas, especially as the decaying social and economic trends have continued their powerful impact. Schools, for instance, are now as or more segregated than before civil rights legislation spurred serious desegregation in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And as the Black professional middle class has left the city, the remaining neighborhoods have become less, not more, stable. Correspondingly, poverty trends for Black Americans have reversed in recent years. The rate has increased steadily from its historic low of 22.5% in 2000 to 27.6% in 2011. 4. The modern achievements of the gay rights movement and the equality of marriage effort are clearly also on a trajectory to achieve full acceptance in American society, and again, with great difficulty and much pain. And also, with not much impact, one way or another, on the larger economic and social trends that define the system problem in its larger dimensions. Indeed, even as the major trends are getting worse. Martin Luther King Jr. confronted the depth of the systemic challenge in the mid-1960s, and again shortly before his death in 1968. The fight to end discrimination was one thing, challenging the economic system was another. Speaking to his staff, one member recalled, "King asked us to turn off the tape recorder. He talked about what he called democratic socialism, and he said, 'I can't say this publicly, and if you say I said it, I'm not going to admit it.' And he talked about the fact that he didn't believe that capitalism as it was constructed could meet the needs of poor people, and that we might need to look at what was a kind of socialism, but a democratic form of socialism." Let us leave aside the word socialism for the moment. The challenge, King declared shortly before he was assassinated, was structural and systemic, not simply political in the traditional sense. We are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power. King's final judgment stands as instructive evidence of his understanding of the nature of systemic challenge, and also as a reminder that given the failures of both traditional socialism and corporate capitalism, it is time to get serious about clarifying not only the question of strategy, but what, in fact, the meaning of changing the system in a truly democratic direction might one day entail.